One thing that I love, here's an interesting segue for you, but I guess pretty much everybody loves television. We certainly love good television. We all grew up on it, and some of us have worked in it or made some or tried to make some of it. And we're going to be talking right now, really, to an expert in the field, someone who has done it and is now teaching it as well as writing about it. He is a fellow named Ross Brown. He is currently a teacher at Dodge College of Film and Media Arts at Chapman University in California. What he's teaching has to do with what's in his new book, which is called Bite-Sized Television, Create Your Own TV Series for the Internet. He's understood that there's been a sea change in really the last 5 years or so between the way people are getting their visions, their stories, their comedies out there. It isn't just the three networks or the dozen or three dozen cable channels. It's going on YouTube or Vevo or Atom TV, or he's got a whole list here in the book of Crackle, Flick Life, Go Fish, Mega Cafe, Rever, Vimeo, forgot about them, and getting their stuff out at a much, much lower cost than could have ever been imaginable even in the 1990s, let's say. And so there's a whole world of opportunities out there and jobs out there. He's writing about it in his book. He's talking about it in his classes. And he knows whereof he speaks because he spent quite a few years in the television mines, the real ones, working on shows like The Cosby Show and Step by Step. And so, Step by Step, Mr. Ross Brown, please take us through what's happening in television today. Ross Brown, welcome to the neighborhood.
Good morning. Great to be on your show. Well, you're quite right. The Internet, and in particular YouTube, have been just a huge change in visual entertainment because they've removed the gatekeepers from the process. And it used to be that you had to get permission to not anybody could make a film, but in order for it to be exhibited, somebody had to do that for you. Now you don't need permission. You can post it yourself. And also because of digital technology, the cost of the equipment and everything you need to make movies is very, very small. So literally millions of people are now making their own short-form television shows, otherwise known as webisodes.
So the question then already is kind of what has been facing musicians they probably started a decade earlier, but when that whole sea change happened with iTunes and MP3s and things like that, of, okay, now anybody can take their song, put it as a digital file, upload it, bring it to CD Baby, bring it to iTunes, blah, blah, blah. Now how do you stand out from the pack?
It's absolutely the process that the musicians went through, and the same thing with writers, with novelists, when everybody said, wait, the Internet means everybody can publish their own novel. The challenge, of course, is getting an audience. How do you make people aware of it? And just throwing your video up on YouTube and hoping that you're going to be discovered that way makes as much sense as if a musician just was singing in the shower and cracked the window and hoped that a record producer would drive by and didn't hear it. It's just not going to happen. So you've got to, in addition to making a quality series, you have to be a marketing person there. You have to go out and do that stuff of selling your product there. So step one, of course, is to make a good product, because nothing is easier to sell than a good product there. So you've got to have a good story to tell. You've got to have compelling characters. And you've got to have a reason that people want to watch your product, which means it either it entertains them in some way or informs them in some way.
Well, let me take it right from there also, before we get to the marketing and the distribution of the actual creation of the program. Is it, I'm sure the skeletal and even the ligaments and muscles, since we've been talking exercise all morning, are kind of the same as they've been forever in situation comedy and dramedy television. Whether you're doing it on a low budget with your own camera for YouTube, or whether you've been doing it for CBS and from Television City in Hollywood, a lot of things are the same. What are the differences?
Well, you're absolutely right that many things are the same. You have to have a good story to tell. You have to have compelling characters. The differences are because you're telling a short story in a shorter space there, you have to be extremely economical in your storytelling. You can't have a throat clearing scene, so to speak, at the beginning. Every second, every frame has to count. Including the titles. You should make the titles entertaining. The title of your series, you have to grab people right away. People have very itchy trigger fingers on their mouse, and if they watch 10 seconds of your video and aren't captured right away, they're clicking something else. So that's one difference. You just have to grab people instantaneously. They're very impatient. On the plus side of the differences, I think, is that you don't have to reach this lowest common denominator audience the way the broadcast networks do. They have to get an audience in the millions and millions. If you have an audience of 200,000 for your internet series, that's a great success on the internet. If you have an audience of 200,000 on CBS, they'll pull the show before the second commercial, and you're gone. So what that means creatively for you is that you don't have to dumb down your work. You can find a more niche audience and more niche topics, things that appeal to you, and then find a like-minded audience out there to be your audience. So I think it gives people a greater creative freedom on subject matter, style, topics, all of those elements of creating a show.
And one of the things that you do mention in the book is that the networks and the big filmmakers and the big producers are paying attention. We may not see the results of this so much, but, we all know, I guess, the name Zach Galifianakis out of nowhere, because he came out of that realm. But what are some other examples of that we may not be so aware of the networks and the big guys taking notice of what is literally just little low budget, couple of cameras, boom, there it is.
Well, yeah, it's several examples. One example is the show on CBS this season called Bleep My Dad Says, which started out as not as a web series, but a series of Twitter postings there. The writer did Twitter postings about the humorous and kind of painful but funny things that his father said to him when he had to move back home when he was 28. It got a huge audience on the internet, became a best-selling book on the New York Times bestseller list. CBS said, hey, we can make a television series out of this premise, and then bought the rights to it, made a series, and now they've bought the rights to several other blogs. I think of it in a way as the 21st century version of when they used to go to the comedy clubs in the 1980s and find stand-up comics like Seinfeld and Roseanne and Tim Allen, because whether it's a stand-up act or a blog or a web series, you're finding someone's creative voice. They have a point of view about life, a point of view about comedy, and usually a central character, and that's the nub and the central part of where you create a television series from is the main character. And so when they can find that voice and that character on the internet, then they know they can partner these new creative people with experienced creative people who, for lack of a better terminology, know how the sausage gets made in network television and can bring it in on time, on budget, and marry these two creative forces there and get fresh creative product.
Are you able to give any kind of real hard number figures on what it costs to do a webisode if you're just like a student at your school? Well, I mean, let's say you didn't have the resources of Chapman University. Let's say they wanted to do it from scratch with a credit card. In the old days, when I was going to film school at NYU 20, 25 years ago, and the success stories were the kids who took 5 credit cards, maxed them out to finish their film, and then somebody saw the film and then they got jobs and whatever else. Those were our biggest success stories. What does it take now?
Well, less is the short answer there. You don't need film. It's digital, so that eliminates a huge amount of that cost there. But really, I would say a few hundred dollars, basically. To give you a really extreme example, the guys who created It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia wrote and acted in and made their own pilot for that show for $75. It was cost of the tape that they used there. But now you need a camcorder of some kind. I suppose you could do it with your cell phone, but that's pretty shaky. But you need a camcorder. You can get them for a couple hundred dollars there. They don't have to be fancy, super professional. Just an average home camcorder will work. your laptop already has editing software on it, whether you know it or not. If it's a Mac, if it's an Apple, it's got iMovies. If it's a Windows computer, it's got Windows Movie Maker. So that's there. The two things that I write about in the book that you might have to rent, and you don't have to buy them, you can rent them, are a tripod and an external microphone, not the microphone that's mounted on your camera, unless you want it to have that hollow sound of those 80s and 90s home movies that your father and uncle used to make, where they'd walk down the hallway and say, "I'm walking down the hallway, I'm coming into Dave's room now. Dave, what are you doing right now?"
So do you recommend those, like you see on TV, those big boom mics with the fuzzy things on them?
Unless you, if you want your series to have that home movie feel, like let's say you did a series called My Parents Are Idiots, and you would just walk into the room and ask your parents a question and your voice would be heard, then you want it to sound like what it is. It's a home movie there. But if you want it to be omniscient, you know, more like the TV shows you see where the camera's steady and the sound isn't distant and hollow, but is actually closer to the actors, so you're not aware of the movie making, you're just absorbed in the story, then I think you're going to want a boom and a mic, and, you know, $40 maybe is what it might cost to rent that for a week.
You would suggest renting rather than, because purchasing would be in the hundreds or thousands?
Yeah,
or?
Absolutely. I think to try it out, you should, it's sort of the musical instrument theory there. Why don't you rent one and see how you like it first before you start spending all this stuff and then end up with a closet that has a clarinet, a guitar, a violin, and everything else in it there. Because, you know, you'll also learn. You'll learn which pieces of equipment you need and which ones benefit you the most and which ones you can do without. And so, you know, I think there's a learning curve there. And ultimately, the thing with web series is production value is not the important factor. The quality of the material and the acting is what's important there. People don't watch web series because they want to see Avatar-like production values. They go to the movie theater for that. People watch web series because they want to be entertained and amused.
I mean, it can't be too amateurish. It's got to be decently lit. It's got, you know, otherwise people are going to go,
Absolutely. It can't be. That's why I recommend the tripod. If everything's shaky handheld, unless that's the effect you want, it looks pretty grim. And the same thing with the hollow sound that comes from the camera-mounted mic there. But most standard home video cameras now can get you a pretty good exposure there.
Absolutely. Can I ask, how long have you been teaching at Chapman University?
I started part-time in 2003, started full-time since 2006, and when I got there, that's when this bite-sized television concept came about. The dean at that time, YouTube had just started then, and the dean asked me if I could come up with a class to teach making videos for iPods, was how he expressed it there. And I said, actually, I've been thinking exactly about that, about this class called Bite-Sized Television to make these new things called web series, webisodes. And it's really a great way to teach television production in an academic setting because it does what film schools do well. They make short films, but it gives you a chance to teach students about episodic storytelling rather than standalone storytelling there. They work with a premise, a set of characters from episode to episode and learn how to build on that from week to week. So that's where the class started. I've now taught it for 3 years there. We've made maybe six different series there. And when I say we make series, we shoot the pilot and then shoot three additional episodes the second semester of each series.
So everyone in the class works on the same series. You don't have little groups of people doing their own thing?
Everybody starts out writing a script. Everybody gets a chance. It's sort of like a content. It's very much like the way the networks work. They buy more scripts than they make pilots, and they make more pilots than they make series. But I have 18 students in the class. Everybody pitches a concept and gets some feedback from me and writes a script and workshops the script out loud in class for a 3 to 5 minute pilot for a web series.
Okay.
Then I get to play God or the network or something like that and choose which two we're going to shoot, and I assign job functions to each of the students and put them in teams. Somebody's the director, somebody's the cinematographer, and so on. And the writer is the executive producer also. We shoot the pilots, edit them, refine the editing, workshop that in class as well. And then in the second semester, we make three additional episodes, and I rotate jobs there, different writer Good. Every week, a different director.
So yeah, I was wondering about that. Yeah, because I remember at NYU when we were doing towards the later stages of film, when we were working in 16mm, we'd go into groups, and then you would, if you weren't the one who was chosen to, like, direct, you were stuck doing either tech or doing sound for the whole semester on one particular film. And it was still a learning experience, but it wasn't what you were there for. It wasn't what you're paying or your parents were paying tuition for a whole semester to hold a microphone, you know, or stuff like that.
Not everybody gets to be the person whose project is chosen for the premier things there. But I'm here.
Okay, cool. Sorry, I thought I lost you there for a minute. Yeah.
No, something might be. I heard something beeping. Who knows what it was? it's somebody on the internet listening to us.
Oh, I knew there was one. Yeah.
but anyway, the digital technology and the lower costs allow for more students to have more opportunities to make films, including making them on their own. And there's also, you know, to get back to you're talking about things that have gone from short form to longer form, this isn't even something that's specific to the internet era there. The Simpsons started out as short 1 to 2 minute pieces that were part of the Tracy Ullman variety show and obviously turned into the longest-running scripted series in primetime television. And if you think even back to the silent movie era, the Charlie Chaplin one-reelers where he played the tramp became feature films eventually. So, you know, this is something that's happened. People have turned short stories into feature films. People look to short content as certainly as a creative calling card for the filmmaker and as a creative laboratory and resource for developing full-length product.
Now, can I ask, since you've been teaching the class for 3-4 years, what are, like, one or two mistakes that students always make in the beginning? What are the things that you always see and you always have to correct or you're kind of...
Right.
Yeah, just curious about that.
Well, okay. Mistake number one at the script level is mistaking a standalone concept for a series concept or a one-time character for a central series character. One of the examples I give in the book of a character that's a great spice character but not a great central series character from broadcast television is the soup Nazi on Seinfeld.
Right.
And he's a really funny character for a couple episodes of Seinfeld, but you wouldn't want to see the Soup Nazi series because it's the same thing over and over again. You don't get any soup. That's the one story he's got. And so that's a mistake. On the production level, one of the challenges/mistakes that the students make is that finding good actors, and you really need good actors, and so the students get lazy and just cast themselves or their friends and don't find capable actors, and it shows on screen. I had a student a couple years ago who had a wonderful premise and wrote a very good script for his web series, one of the ones we made. It was called Model Family, and the premise was that there was a 15-year-old boy who felt out of place in his family because everybody else in his family was a television spokesmodel. His father was the brawny paper towel guy,
yeah.
His mother was the Victoria's Secret underwear model, and his brother was like a shirtless Abercrombie jeans kind of model, and they were in their television characters all the time. That's the way they spoke in real life.
That's funny.
And it was a very, very funny idea and a great way to do something twist on a standard thing, a family sitcom.
Yeah.
And perfect for the internet. The student just didn't get the right people to come in to play the dad, so he cast himself as the dad.
Oh.
And, you know, I said, and yeah, he had a beard and he wore a plaid flannel shirt, but I said, look, for this series to work, we have to believe this is really a family, and you look not that much older than the kid, so it becomes fake, like we're putting on a show in the barn rather than a real play that we're seeing.
So I didn't realize that you did that they were doing auditions for outside actors. I thought everything had to be within the all the kids had all the jobs in the thing, but they could cast outside. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, I want them to, and I mean they can cast other students who are theater students or even film students who are legitimately good actors.
Right.
I'm not against that at all, but I think finding actors is a very important thing. And, you know, to address the, at least your local audience in Northern Colorado, we, you know, we're in Los Angeles, we have a greater access, but, you know, there's still the theater department at college, there's still local theaters there, and I think you should go out of your way to find the best possible on-camera talent.
Well, we do have a theater or two in Colorado. You know, we have the Union Colony Dinner Theater, you know, we got that. Let's not denigrate Northern Colorado, please.
By no means, it's a fabulous state. It's glorious and beautiful, and it definitely has culture. But
it's not Los Angeles.
John Malkovich is in doing theater in Northern Colorado. Last time I checked.
Well, Vicki Lawrence is. So there.
Well, there you go.
Now we're talking to Ross Brown on Dave's Gone By, and we've talked a bit about the making of webisodes and the television. So let's see. Oh, and you know what? Before we get to your history and your past, which I'm really excited about, I did want to get back to the idea of once the webisode is out there, what are your suggestions for getting it really out there and marketing it? Because that is the second step. If 300 people watch it on YouTube, unless one of those persons is Steven Spielberg, what have you got? So that's the next step. What is the next step?
Obviously, you don't have a marketing department like Warner Brothers or that kind of budget or anything, so you're going to have to use your personal resources there. And, you start with the obvious, your email list and your Facebook and other social media sites there. But I think the key on those in those two areas is not just to put up a notice that says, hey, check out my new series, but to go the next step and say, if you like it, please post this on your site and pass it along, because that's what going viral is all about. There is that it gets passed along. So if you know 200 people, okay, that's 200 people. But if each of those 200 people knows 200 people, now that's 40,000 that have found out about it. Now there's probably some overlap in who they know, so maybe it's 20,000. But that's how things go viral. And so you've got to be bold enough to ask people to be your sales force in a way. And if you've made a good product, they're happy to do it. And I think the thing, and this is why humor dominates the internet video world, there is humor is what people post more than anything else. Mm-hmm. If you think about the videos that you get either emailed to you or posted on Facebook or whatever in the course of a week, 9 out of 10 that were posted because somebody thought they were funny.
Right. Well, but at the same time, you have to watch out for, I love where you quote the film Idiocracy, which I now have to see. Mike Judge, who created Beavis and Butthead and also King of the Hill, I'll just read this paragraph. You can't just slap together some half-baked notion, grab a camcorder, and point it randomly at things that strike you as interesting or funny. That's just video masturbation, although there is something to be said for that. That's parenthetically mine. All you end up with, as Mike Judge suggests in his film Idiocracy, is a show called Ow, My Balls, which is true. It's 5 seconds of somebody getting hit in the nuts and grabbing their ball and going, ow, which is funny. But there's no series. Maybe I could view a series on that. I think I might enjoy that. But it would be a very...
there's got to be more than one episode there, and there also, hopefully has a broader humor appeal than that, although I guess you can't get any broader.
Can't get any broader. And come to think of it, there is a show called, basically, that is Ow, My Balls. It's called America's Funniest Home Videos.
Exactly. It was done for a long time there. But America's Home Videos worked on the premise of one-time videos. They weren't webisode series. Sure. It was a series, but it was an anthology series, so to speak. But, if you want to create something that has multiple episodes, you'll probably need to find a different storyline than Ow, My Balls.
Although, one of the nice things that webisodes opens up is the idea, and you go back and forth on this, of anything can be a good idea if you do it right. You tell the story, tell the Drape story.
Television for a long time, and on one project I was partnered with a woman who'd been an ABC executive in comedy development there. So she'd been there for 5 or 6 years, and they hear hundreds and hundreds of pitches every year. And so I just asked her one day, we were having lunch, I said, okay, what's the worst pitch pitch you ever, worst idea you ever got pitched as a network executive. And she was very funny the way she did it. She kind of put her finger on her chin very thoughtfully and looked up at the sky and went, talking drapes. And I said, what, talking drapes? How is talking drapes a series? And we laughed about this. And then I told this story in a room full of writers a year later. And one of the writers who was hearing the story said, I know the person who pitched that idea, because I had mentioned the writer's name, which I won't do on the air here. And she called up the writer who pitched the talking drapes idea and said, you pitched a series about talking drapes? And the guy said, okay, look, that could have worked. And
you know what? With the right writer, it could. Because if you think about the concept...
Of course. And I am a hugely bad prognosticator of what is going to strike a chord with the public and not myself. I began my career as a gopher and a PA for companies that made TV commercials. And one of the first commercials I worked on when I graduated from college, so this is 1976, was for IBM. And they had a new machine they were testing out at a bank in Seattle and at the ferry terminal there, where you could put a credit card like device in and get money out of your bank account.
Wow, what a concept.
What a concept there, right? And my response, honest to God, at the time was, who the hell is going to use this thing? You just trust that it gives you the right amount of money? What if it says it gave you $60, but it only gave you $40? Nobody's going to use this. Well, I use ATMs all the time now. I was wrong. Oops, I was wrong. Same thing with my friend from journalism school, who at the same time did a story, maybe a year later, on the first personal computer store in Orange County, California, and his response was, why would an individual person need a computer?
Dude, you know, he and you should not feel bad, because when computers first started making inroads into, the home use rather than just the school or business, and my folks were like, well, you know, should we get you a computer? And I was like, no, maybe if I just get an electronic typewriter, because then it has all the cool stuff. It's got the paper, you know, you can hand something on paper, and you can make mistakes and correct them. What do I need a computer for? I honestly said that. What use is a computer going to be to me?
We all make mistakes, and especially when you work in a creative field, and you say, well, okay, this isn't going to work. I mentioned to you before we were on the air that I'm friends with a guy, a writer, producer named Joel Cerno, who's one of the creators of 24, and he told me that when he and his writing partner were meeting, thinking of ideas, he pitched the idea to his partner at breakfast one morning. He said, well, this is a show called 24, and it happens in real time, and, you know, he explained the premise to it, and his partner's response was, my head hurts just thinking about trying to write that. Don't ever bring up that idea again. But he brought it up again, and it was a pretty good thing for both of them that they did. Once again, I heard the idea and said, oh, man, I don't know how you do that every week. And then I saw the pilot and said, that's a great idea. So there you go. If it's executed really well, can be done great. I just went last night, you know, in the feature film realm. Wait a minute, you're going to show us a feature film about a king who has a speech impediment? How is that a movie? Well, it was a great movie.
There you go, exactly. I mean, I would never naysay anything until I saw the final, because you really, really never know what can work if it's made to do so. But let me ask, how did you go, Ross Brown, from being a gopher and working on commercials to actually getting into the writer's room on network TV?
Well, when I was in college, I was interested in both film production and writing. But I got the opportunity to go into production because my father worked in the advertising industry, and he said, hey, there are these companies that make TV commercials. And he got me some interviews for summer work. I was still in college, actually. Yeah. And I started working as a gopher at these places. And, you know, you hear about, well, you got to start at the bottom and pay your dues. Really, absolutely true. One of my first jobs in working on commercials is I stood in for a dog in a dog food commercial. I mean, on my hands and knees in front of the bowl of dog food, because it was cheaper. They didn't want to tire out the star dog, and it was cheaper to hire me than to hire a second dog.
Wait, why did you have to physically be there? Because you weren't going to be in the shot. So what?
No, they were lighting me. I was the lighting stand-in for the dog.
Wow.
And I think there was a certain amount lot of hazing going on too, since my father was an advertising exec. But anyway, that's where I started. I work in the production end of the business. I worked my way up from dog stand in to doing other functions. I eventually got enough experience to become an assistant director and worked in feature films and television as an assistant director. I worked on a couple films that people have seen widely. I worked on the first National Lampoon's Vacation as the second assistant director there.
And oh, wow.
Private Benjamin. And I kept writing.
Well, actually, Ross, let me stop you there. What does an assistant director do?
The assistant director, there are multiple assistant directors, and they are basically the organizers for the director. They make sure that the elements the director needs, the cast getting through makeup, the locations, the right equipment, and that all the departments are informed about what we're doing, and they coordinate the logistics for the director so the director can focus on the creative work of the day with the actors and the cinematographer.
Well, that's pretty cool. So you did that for Private Benjamin and
National... I did it for Private Benjamin. Yep, I've seen Kate Hudson naked. That's because she was an infant when Goldie Hawn was doing Private Benjamin, and Goldie Hawn would be changing her in her trailer.
Okay.
So I did that for a while. I kept writing and while I was making a living as an assistant director, and I was writing spec sitcoms. Just sit down and see something on the air, would write a script. I got good at it eventually, and then I got lucky, because you have to get a little bit lucky in show business, although one of my good friends' definitions of luck is preparedness plus opportunity. So you got to be doing your work so that when the opportunity comes, you can take advantage of it. But I met my wife, whose uncle happened to be a CBS executive, and he read my spec script.
Oh, well, yeah, okay, I met my wife, whose uncle happened to... Did you realize you didn't have to work for the previous 5 years doing all... You didn't have to be the dog? All you had to do was marry the woman?
That's not true, dude. So the thing is, just meeting him wouldn't have meant anything other than he's a lovely guy if I didn't have scripts that he could get to an agent, and that the agent felt could go to other producers and say, yeah, this fella can write, and so on.
I'm kidding, but still, that's kind of like... Oh, yeah, I worked really, really hard. You have to start from the ground over. Oh, yeah, and then I married the... I married the executives.
I married Steven Spielberg's daughter. Right, yeah. Anyway, that's how I got an agent, although it didn't happen right away. The agent read my spec scripts. I had, at the time, a taxi script that I had written with a partner and a script for a show called Police Squad that lasted six episodes, but was the basis for the Naked Gun movies. And the agent read them. Met with me and said, these are very good scripts. I cannot represent you based on them because you're not writing with your partner any longer, so I can't send the taxi out. And Police Squad isn't on the air anymore, and there's nothing like it anyway, so you got to write another script. So I wrote a Cheers script. This is very early in the life of the series Cheers. I sent it to him, didn't hear back from him for about 3 weeks, and called him, and this is the dreaded phone call when you haven't heard from somebody in show business, because you know the answer is either I hated it or I haven't gotten to it yet. But when I called him, he took the phone call, the agent did, and I asked if he'd read the script, and he said, I'll never forget his rhythm on this, he said, yeah, it was really funny.
Oh.
And then just paused, and I said, it was like a pause for 5 seconds on the telephone, and then I said, isn't that good for a comedy? And he said, well, it is, but it's too dirty for even for Cheers. Your script's like an R-rated Cheers, which became a joke between us. He's still my agent, because everything I wrote in most of my professional career was squeaky clean, like The Cosby Show and The Facts of Life, and nobody believed I could write adult humor in the creative community. And I used to tell him, well, can we send out that Cheers script he thought was too dirty?
Well, actually, I was a little concerning that you're what you did write for, and also that you're a college teacher. I'm a little surprised by the saltiness of the book and some of your attitude. I mean, it is an R or X rated, but it has some pretty PG-13 attitude. It's not a textbook, ladies and gentlemen. It's a real kind of, this man is talking to you the way he would talk to you, you know, sitting next to you in a bar giving you advice about television, which is kind of neat.
And I actually try and teach that way. I mean, I think, you know, yes, you want to make sure you're imparting the information, but it was one of the challenges of writing the book. I'd written drama and comedy, you know, dramatic form and comedic form, but I hadn't written prose like this, and said, how do I make this entertaining for the internet generation? Because they, you know, just getting them to read a book sometimes sometimes is a challenge. And I think that's your obligation as a writer and as a teacher, is to make the information entertaining so that the value of it can be actually obtained by the students.
Well, I didn't mean to interrupt you, though, in getting through how you got to this wonderful story. So he loved the agent who, he was already your agent, but he couldn't get you anything yet. So
he write another script. I wrote another cheer script. He liked it. Made some suggestions for the second half of it, which I did as rewrites. And then he said, "Okay, now I can take you on." And to come back to the idea that nobody's a good prognosticator, he took on my script, sent it out there. He called me 2 months later and said, "I have very good news. Bill Cosby is doing a new television show, and they like your script and they want to hire you as a writer there, but you need to go to New York." And so my wife, I had been out of town on a television series the previous year while my wife was pregnant and we had an 8-year-old. And so going out of town again would have been a disaster for my marriage. I declined the job.
Oh, wow.
My wife's uncle, this is 2 weeks before Cosby premieres, my wife's uncle, the CBS executive, says, and I quote, "You're better off not taking this job because the show's in a terrible time slot. It's up against Magnum PI, so it's probably not going to last more than 13 weeks.
Okay.
Well, the Cosby Show lasted more than 13 weeks and was an enormous...
No, wait a minute. But you turned it down.
I turned it down. Well, there's a follow-up to that in this story.
Yeah. Okay.
I turned it down. The CBS exec says what he says about the show's not going to last. It premieres. It's the hit of the century. My wife now feels horrible at that time, thinking she's denied me my dream of becoming a writer. The agent was very calm about the whole thing and said, "It's just a job. We'll find you another job. You're a good writer." So I got a job. I had a day job as an assistant director on a television series called Knots Landing at the time.
Oh, yeah, okay.
The bills were paid, and he got me a freelance assignment on a TV show called Webster, and that was my first professional writing assignment. Wrote the script, and then in the spring, my wife said, "You know, the baby's older now. We've had more time together. If the Cosby job was there for next year, I could deal with you being away." And I said, "Oh, like they're going to have a job now that it's a huge hit." But they did, and they hired me the next year.
Oh, my goodness. And you were with them for how long?
I was with the show for a year, and then I came back to California. But it really was an all's well that ends well kind of situation where I'm still married, happily so, to the same woman, and I had a television career, and I got to work on Cosby. So,
take us through this, if you please. It's Monday morning, and you have a job at the Cosby Show. What is your week like writing for? And extrapolating to the other programs you've written for, but certainly Cosby.
Well, Cosby was a little bit of an anomaly because Bill was such a creative force on the show. But I think the real question is, what's an average week on a sitcom like?
Uh-huh.
Monday morning at 10 o'clock, and there's been pre-production time and people have written scripts, but to take you through the production week, Monday morning at 10 o'clock, everybody gathers for what's called the table reading. So you're in a room like a hotel, not as large as a ballroom, but a meeting room that has maybe 50 or 60 people in it.
Wow.
And tables set up in a big square. The actors, the writers, the producers, the director, certainly the network and studio personnel, and other key creative crew members. They read the script aloud at the table. The script's in front of them, and you get to, this is the first step in learning more about a script. We're all professional writers, but there's a big difference between reading something on a page and hearing it read aloud by live actors.
Mm-hmm.
And so you hear what works, you hear what doesn't work. You also get a timing on the script. So the script supervisor says, "Hey, you're 8 minutes long. You got to cut 6 pages out of the script." Things like that. The actors say if they have any thoughts about the script and their character. The network offers their thoughts. And then the writers go back to their room where they do their writing and do a rewrite, and you have to do the entire rewrite that day, no matter how long it takes you, because at 10 o'clock on Tuesday morning, the actors are going to start rehearsing on the stage. So if the script's in good shape, everybody gets to go home for dinner, and if the script's in bad shape, everybody stays till midnight or 2 in the morning and does the rewrite there. Everybody, meaning the writers. The next day, the actors work on the stage from 10 to about 4 in the afternoon with the director, rehearsing and blocking the script. The writers work on future scripts. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you come down to the stage and see what's called a run-through, which is a live performance without cameras or costumes or lights of the play, of that week's episode.
Right.
And then you discuss it. You have a sort of a mutual creative exchange session with the actors where you suggest to them and the director things they might do differently. They suggest to you things that they need in the script to help them do those things. And then you go back, eat dinner, and do another rewrite on Tuesday night. Same thing. Got to get done that night because Wednesday morning at 10, they come in and rehearse again. At 4 o'clock, you see another run through of the show, but this one the network and the studio executives attend. They weigh in on their thoughts and feelings. You do another rewrite Wednesday night. Thursday's a technical day for the stage. They do what's called camera block the show. They, in a multi-camera live sitcom, there is this ballet of cameras, so it's performed like a play, and three or four cameras capture all of the shots simultaneously, as opposed to a movie where they do it shot by shot by shot by shot. And so they camera block the show. The writers work on future episodes, as they do on Friday morning, and then Friday afternoon, in the early afternoon, there is a dress rehearsal of the show. You make final adjustments. Everybody breaks for an early meal, and then at 6 or 7 o'clock, the audience is there, and right. You shoot the show in front of the audience.
Wow. Let me ask you something. Is it by Friday evening also that next week's script has its first draft, or are the writers working over the weekend?
On well-organized ahead-of-the-game show, certainly the first draft of the script was done weeks before that Friday, and a rewrite of that script was done at least a week ahead of time, so it's ready to go. But yeah, on shows that get behind schedule or aren't as good about working ahead, they're there on the weekend getting the script ready. It varies greatly based on the personality of the showrunner, and you know, one of the watchwords that you said when I was a writer working my way up through the ranks was never work for a recently divorced showrunner because they don't want to go home to their empty apartment.
No, wait, what is a showrunner? Remind everybody.
The showrunner is the head writer and producer of the show. Sorry to use lingo there.
Yeah, sure.
The people who don't want to go home will do things to stall on the rewrite, like, let's just watch the first half of Monday Night Football. And and I wanted to go home, so I said, I'll stay here as long as it takes to make the script good, but I'm not staying here to sit around and screw around with you guys. I got a life, and I hope you guys do too.
So let me also ask, in the actual physical writing process, I mean, how many people are in? I mean, is it just like the Dick Van Dyke Show, where they're just in a room with a blank page, or does someone come in with like a bit of a spec script and then everybody pitches in?
No, it's a group process, but it's not as small as the Dick Van Dyke Show. Most shows have somewhere between, I'd say, 6 and 8 or 9 writers, and the process, you know, this is the process I described to you as the production process there. But before that happened, even before the show started production that semester or that season, I would sit down with my writing staff, say on a show like Step by Step, where I was the head writer, 7 weeks ahead of production, and say, okay, so let's talk about this season. What are the overall arcs we're going to explore this season? How old are our kids? Because we had a show where kids aged every year, and so what are they going through in their lives? What did your kids go through at those ages? Pitch any half-baked, quarter-baked idea you have. We'll throw out 100 ideas in 2 days. And then we'll say, okay, these are the most promising ones. Let's develop them. We'll pick one, develop the story. It'll take us probably 2 days of talking through what we call is beating out a story, which means finding the beats of the story, the first thing that happens, the second thing that happens, how the plot develops. And then after 2 days and getting network approval of the story, I would pick a writer and say, okay, Susan, you're writing this episode, and send her out of the room for 7 or 8 days to go write a first draft. And we'd move, while Susie's out doing her work, the rest of us would move on and say, okay, episode two, and go through the same process. It's very much like a creative assembly line or factory there, although a really fun one.
But I like the idea that at its root, it isn't just everybody sitting in the room and trying to create a script from scratch and everybody like throwing in the next line of dialogue. There's always someone who's writing the script, the main one.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in that. Some shows they do write them in hideous showbiz terminology, that is when everybody just, as a group, writes the script from page one together. That is referred to in the sitcom business as gangbanging a script.
Well, yeah. Okay.
And I never liked doing that because I'm a writer, and I believe we can improve the script as a group, but I think that somewhere somebody's got to go sit down and take a first pass at a script and be the writer, and that there's nothing harder than that part where you've really got to go from the blank page to something, and then once you have something, it's a whole lot easier.
Now, I used to be friends and acquaintances with a fellow named Mark Rothman. He was a writer on The Odd Couple and a couple of shows of that era. And one of the things that he kind of complained about was that after a while, there is an ageist system in Hollywood and television, and that you pass a certain point when your services are not necessarily needed anymore because for the mere reason that you're no longer 20-something or 30-something. True?
It's true, and it happens for a number of reasons. Some of it is, just flat-out ageism. Some of it is that the advertising community, so it's a domino effect, because advertisers want to get young viewers, so the networks want to deliver young viewers for the advertisers, and they believe that young writers are the people who can relate to young viewers. That's one reason. Another reason is that television just evolves creatively over time, and so when you've worked for a long time in the television industry, your 20-year-old credits look like 20-year-old shows, and so people then start typecasting you, and you as that's an old-fashioned writer, and you've got to fight hard to rebrand yourself, so to speak, and write fresh material, and it can be difficult. It's really unfortunate, and it's gotten worse over time. When I was a young writer, it was quite a tradition to have one older writer, meaning over 60, on your show.
Yeah.
And for my era, these guys were unbelievably richly talented and
sure.
experienced. They had worked in the pre-television era on radio. Some of them had written a lot of vaudeville. There was a guy who worked on one show that if you pitched any joke, it didn't matter what joke it was, he could tell you the roots of that joke. This is how we did that joke in vaudeville. This is how it was done in radio. This is how they got changed in live television. And, they had great experience and insight to offer, and I really valued what those guys were able to teach me, the guys who'd written for Jack Benny, guys who'd written for Bob Hope.
But let me ask then, also, after Step by Step, after the series that ran 7 years with Suzanne Summers, there was a point when you kind of moved away more out of television and into academia? Was it by choice?
Yeah.
Did you burn out, or what was the deal?
Some of both, to be honest. There were a number of factors. Some of it was my age and the age of my credits. Some of it was the fact that when that happened to me at the sort of the turn of the millennia there, around 2000, was also the time when the sitcom business in general was just shrinking. That, at the height of sitcoms in the early 90s, there were 80 of them on the combined broadcast networks. NBC alone had 20 sitcoms on their schedule, and by 2001 or so, there were only 20 sitcoms total on television.
Oh, wow.
And so three-quarters of the jobs had gone away. And combined with that, to be honest, that schedule that I described to you where you keep working late nights and everything became a little less appealing to me. And I had other things I wanted to do, so there was a little bit of getting pushed and a little bit of jumping myself, and I'm really pleased with what I've been able to do. I've written in other areas now. I've written for the stage and really enjoy that.
Oh, good. Yeah.
And I love teaching. I loved writing the book, too. I've had a great opportunity to do things that a lot of people really would kill to get a chance to do, to write for Bill Cosby, to write a hit TV show on ABC for 6 years, and work with comedy writers every day.
Yeah, one of your credits somewhere mentioned that you worked with both Mel Brooks and Harold Ramis. How did those... No, seriously,
Not as a writer. I did those when I was an assistant director. I was the assistant director, second assistant director on National Lampoon's Vacation, and Harold was the director on Vacation. And I worked with Mel when I was a production assistant on a movie that his now late wife Anne Bancroft directed called Fatso. And then on another movie they did together as actors, I was in an assistant director called To Be or Not to Be. That was a remake of a Jack Benny movie, actually.
Right, yes. So let me ask, any stories about Mel and Anne? Were probably great nuts together.
They were, you know. I'll tell you one story about Anne that's not mine, but a friend of mine did. He was a production manager on the movie. Anne is, an icon in many ways, certainly for being Mrs. Robinson in The Graduate. And she's an incredibly beautiful woman in person as well as on the screen. And so my friend was location scouting with Anne on Fatso, which she was directing. And somehow the topic of The Graduate came up, and she said something like, "I never understood why people thought I was so sexy in that movie." And my friend said, in his mind, he wanted to pull over and go into a motel with her immediately. Are you kidding me, Mrs. Robinson? I'll tell you another great story about Harold Ramis. We'd worked on Vacation, as I said, and immediately after Vacation, he had written and was now acting in Ghostbusters. And I was on the Warner Brothers lot and ran into Harold while he was shooting Ghostbusters. And so I said to him, are you enjoying just acting now instead of having to be responsible for everything and being the director? And he said, "Yeah, it's all right if you don't mind being blown off the screen every day by Bill Murray." Yeah. And I remember thinking, and I said to Harold, "Oh, come on, you're a funny guy." And he said, "I'm just telling you, wait till the movie comes out." And then the movie came out, and I said, "Yeah, it got blown off the screen by Bill Murray."
Let me ask, did you try your hand at directing? Because I see producing credits, right, certainly, and writing credits, but not necessarily directing credits. Was that not where you wanted to go?
No, I think maybe early on I thought, I want to be a director because the way everybody thinks, I want to be a director. But once I started writing, and especially being a writer-producer and having the kind of control I had creatively in television, I really enjoyed that, and it felt like that was who I was and where I could make my best contribution. So I never went the directing route, and I really stepped back with the directors I work with, whether it's in television or in the theater, and really want them to give their creative input, because I think everybody has different talents, and I found what mine is, and so I want the other people to do what they do well, the actors and the director and so on. And I've found over time that you need to give creative people creative freedom to do what they do, and if you try and micromanage them, you're shortchanging yourself because you're not getting their best.
Well, let me ask, the last question that we have for Ross Brown, aside from reminding everyone where they can get, that's not really a question, just telling people, you can get Bite-Sized Television. It is published by, MW?
Michael Weese Productions, and it's MWP.com, or you can go to the usual places, Amazon.com, your local bookstore, Barnes & Noble, Borders, all those places there. It's readily available. And, if you're interested in making web series, I encourage you to take a look at the book, because I think it can help you out.
Yeah, it's very, very readable. It's very informative. And also, one of the things that we can mention, since this program is coming out of the University of Northern Colorado, that it has pretty much at the end of every chapter, like a teacher section. So it can be kind of used as a textbook in that way as well. It can be a guided thing.
Yeah, it was written for two audiences, to be a textbook, not only at the university level, but I think at the high school and even junior high school level. I mean, the people younger and younger are becoming more and more sophisticated at making videos there. And so I think, more high schools are having video classes, and I think it could serve that kind of class well, because it is low-budget projects we're talking about, and because you don't have a lot of equipment needs or money needs, and it is a kit for teachers.
So let me ask you then, the final question for Ross Brown is, what creatively are you working on apart from all the webisodes that you're doing within class at Chapman University? Are you doing webisodes? Are you writing scripts? What are you doing?
Drama of a play about a coal mining accident, if you can believe. That's my latest creative work there. I haven't chosen to write and produce webisodes myself. I may at some point in time when the right idea comes along, but I sort of go where it's the mystery of the creative muse there, that whatever pops into my mind, to work on, then I get excited about, that's where I put my energies, and I'm fortunate that I never have enough time to do everything that I want to do.
Oh, yeah.
Between writing the book and teaching and writing my own creative material, there just isn't enough time to do everything, but I think that's a really good problem to have.
Well, I really appreciate your taking the time this Saturday morning to be with us in the neighborhood. It's been really so fun and informative talking to you, just as it is fun and informative reading your book, Bite-Sized Television. Certainly want to wish you absolutely the best in all your endeavors, teaching and writing and webisoding, if you decide to do it. And just thanking you so much, Ross Brown, for being in the neighborhood.
Thanks so much, Dave. And if there were a topic that you want to talk to me about, of the many things I do, I'd be happy to be on the show again.
Would love it. Thank you, man. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.